How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Welcome back, everybody, to Chatter on Books. Hope you're doing well, staying healthy. It's really hard these days, but do the best you can. And in just a little bit, we are going to be talking to Steve Roberts, who I've known for so long, I shouldn't say it, because it would age both of us. And he is going to be talking to us about his book, Cokie, A Life Well Lived, which is about his partner in life and work and everything, Cokie Roberts, a legend also. Really remarkable, wonderful book. Right now, we have Claude Jennings doing all the important work. We have David Aldridge zooming in. And Jamie McIntyre is back off the injured reserve list. Welcome back, Jamie.
It's good to be back. Good to be anywhere.
Can you give us the CNN headlines version of what happened?
So 2.5 months ago, I suffered severe burns to my left hand in a small cooking fire in my kitchen. Apparently, I was heating up some cooking oil, and apparently I used a pan that was had a very thin bottom on a very hot burner, and it burst into flames. And as you know, when you have like a grease fire or an oil fire, you don't put water on that.
Right.
So I had quickly grabbed the lid of the pot to smother the fire, which I did successfully, and was about to congratulate myself when I looked over and noticed that my left hand was severely burned. Apparently the flaming hot oil had gotten on my hand, and very quickly, and this is a matter of just seconds, third degree burn. So long story short, I ended up a week in the Washington Hospital Center burn unit, which, by the way, if you ever get burned, that's where you want to go.
Can we just stop for a second? Anybody sure. Spending a week in the hospital, that's a big deal, Jamie.
Well, because I had to get a skin graft. You know, what they do is it's amazing what they can do for these things. You know, years ago, you would have just had to wait for it to heal, which would take months. But, they took a big patch of skin off my thigh, and they grafted that onto my thumb and forefinger and index finger to replace the skin that was burned away. And the graft has taken pretty well. I have a nice little compression glove that I'll be wearing for a year or so. But it's like a lot of things. It just could have been so much worse.
Yeah, that's right.
Because I'm right-handed. It happened to my left hand. Yes, it was very, you know, they tell you that burns are one of the most painful injuries. And yes, it was very painful. But I do have to say, when I was ranking the pain, the night I had to pass a kidney stone was worse in the moment. That was like writhing on the floor pain. This was just like a constant pain. Once I got medical attention, the first thing they did, I went to Shady Grove Hospital, and then they transferred me to Washington Hospital Center. But the first, after they treated me, they gave me morphine. Immediately, I was feeling better with the morphine.
Yeah.
And then it's all about pain management. And yes, it's painful. And yes, my hand's kind of still sore. The joints are sore and the skin is kind of tender, but it's not what I think, you know, I can think of 100 things that would be more painful, more debilitating and worse. And I will have a cool scar on my leg. So I'm going to have to come up with a much better story once we get
as time goes on. I think a much better
something
story.
To what, do with what my were you going to as a war correspondent or something.
If you had set the pot on fire, what would you have been making that night?
So I was making popcorn, believe it or not, because we had a popcorn popper and it went on the fritz. And making popcorn the old fashioned way, just put, you know, in a pot, in a big pot.
Yeah.
My wife, Roberta, won't let me near the stove.
I was just going to say, I know a little bit.
I made popcorn.
I know a little bit about the last couple of months. I know this has been a challenge for Roberta. So hats off to Roberta for putting up with you for the last 2.5 months.
And guess what? Okay. Guess what I got for Christmas, by the way?
An automatic popcorn maker?
A new popcorn popper. I got that going for me.
I thought about sending you a nice pair of gloves, but I thought maybe too soon. So, well, we're glad you're doing okay. Okay, Claude, now we get to talk about you. And we talked about you a little bit last week when Lauren was taking care of us. Little thing called a Marconi Award. which you never told us about. I had to find out actually reading social media and things like that, which really pains me. But I'm going to let Jamie chime in here because I know a little bit from the broadcasting world from days gone by. And our Marconi Award is a big deal. And you, and I want to make sure I get his name right, Jerry Woods, had a podcast called We Need to Talk. Mm-hmm. And it won a Marconi Award, which is pretty remarkable. So congratulations, but tell us all about it.
Thank you. No, thank you. Well, my apologies for not mentioning it. I'm not really a big self-promoter, I guess. But so we won this Marconi for this podcast, We Need to Talk. We basically started it in 2020. And it's, I guess the subtitle is Everything You Wanted to Talk About Race, but Didn't Know Where to Start. Because, you know, with all the stuff happening, we just felt like we wanted to, you know, just create a place where people can say what they feel, whether you agree, disagree, whatever, but just kind of hash things out a little bit in kind of a light way. Now, I will say this. Neither one of us submitted it. There was someone else at a radio station that I worked for that submitted it because they thought it was good. Next thing I know, we were nominated. And when I looked at the list of the of the other folks who were nominated, because we were coming out of 2020 when the nomination process happened in 2021, I thought we had a good shot because it was the only serious one. Like it was such a serious year that the other podcast was like a car podcast and then one about stressed out moms. And I was like, I think we have a shot because I mean, the rest of this stuff is kind of, I mean, it's not, I mean, it's a little goofy, but it's like, it was such a serious year. And then next thing you know, we had like kind of a watch party and they said, you know, for a podcast of the year, you know, for the Marconi, it goes to We Need to Talk. And we just had a blast and had a little, celebration. And then, so, you know, I mean, it's an award and it's cool to be recognized. It's a big deal.
And it's nice that somebody from your station nominated you or somebody who knew nominated the show, which is great.
It doesn't come with cash, but that's fine. Yeah.
That will
follow. I mean, we get up for cash, but that's
fine. You know, Claude, you continue with this podcast, man, and money is just going to roll in.
There you go.
Jamie, that's a big deal, right? Jamie, you're from radio. Did you ever win a Marconi?
No, I remember a couple of times when I was giving speeches, I would be introduced as an award seeking journalist. but no, I never got the big thing, you know, but it is a big deal. It's
a big deal.
It's almost as big as Les Nessman's Buckeye Newshawk Award that he won.
KRP. Very good. Remember that very one. Good.
But you know, actually seriously, you know, if you're a journalist, you know, they give award. There's all kinds of awards out there, and some of them are very prestigious, and some of them are just, you know, like the Golden Globes. But you know, I've seen a lot of awards. And there's a tendency by people to sort of play down awards, particularly people like me who haven't won that many, to say they don't really count. And I've seen a lot of awards go to people who didn't actually deserve them. And I've seen a lot of really deserving people who never got awards. So it's always gratifying when occasionally somebody who really deserves recognition gets it. So I'm
excellent
very excited for Claude. The closest I ever got was I got a certificate of participation from the National Footwear Foundation for my investigative series, Shoes, Fetish, or Necessity. So, not quite up the
that's
same. And Claude, that you're not that good at self-promotion because every time you said the name of the podcast, We Need to Talk, you just kind of threw, it was kind of a throwaway. You have to punch that. Right,
we need to talk.
So people know they want to know. We're like, well, where do I go hear this award-winning podcast?
Yeah,
and it's the name of it again is We Need to Talk. Is that it?
Correct.
Well, we need to talk about that.
Good job, Jamie.
Thank you, Jamie.
Claude, we're very proud, and now I will only introduce you as award-winning Claude Jennings doing the important work.
Well, thank you.
Okay, very quickly, I think it was maybe our last show in December. I begged people to go to Apple iTunes and write reviews about this show. Because I was so offended about the one that would pop up in the top accusing David and me of being racist. Could never figure out why, David. So for all of those people who over the holidays, busy time, went and wrote reviews, thank you very, very much. There are several really good ones at the top of the charts, which I love. And I'm going to read a couple of them. The first one I don't understand at all. And I'm going to be careful with people's names. This is from Marvin. Tori despises the 400 meter hurdles and David finds the 1500 meters miserable. I have no idea what that means because I don't think we ever talked about, I don't know. I think it's code for something else. Okay.
We may have talked about track once with someone.
Did we?
But I don't think so.
I've never, the only thing I've ever run for is last call. I have never run for a race in my entire life. Okay, second one. This is from Hector. It's like a perfect DC cocktail hour talking about the show. It's like getting around and talking about books and current affairs with your DC friends, except they're all wittier, smarter, and have better stories than your DC friends. Everyone is a delight, and the book talks are a perfect mix of inside baseball and summary. I love that.
That's okay, nice.
But here's my favorite, David. This is for you. This is from SM, I won't say the last. Fun and smart show. I continue to enjoy this podcast. I keep finding myself actually learning something by mistake. That's certainly not their goal, but the discussion is so smart that I just can't help myself.
It's absolutely our goal.
we try to be pedagogic without being pedantic.
Exactly.
My bumper sticker.
I have sought out several books that I never would have thought about otherwise. Most recently, I loved the final revival of Opal and Nev. Now, if we could only get Aldrich to write a book.
Give it a rest.
Never. That's my New Year's resolution. Okay, very quickly, because I see the lovely and talented Steve Roberts is getting ready to roll. Who knew that there was a school, Lake Superior State University in Michigan? And who knew, I didn't know this, that every year since 1976, they have published a list of words and phrases that they think should be banished. And these are the
banished.
These are the words from Lake Superior State University. An annual banished words list to uphold, protect, and support excellence in language by encouraging avoidance of words and terms that are overworked, redundant, oxymoronic, cliched, illogical, nonsensical, and otherwise ineffective, baffling, or irritating. Evidently, this is such a big deal that in 1994, George Carlin sent in a nomination. He wanted them to get rid of bada boom, bada bing, which is good. Okay. But here are some of the words and phrases they want banished in 2022. The first one, wait what? Wait, comma, what? Question mark?
Wait, what?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Agree? Yeah. David, you agree? Should be banished?
I guess. Well, yeah, it's kind of Twitterish, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of.
Yeah.
Aren't we all? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Fine.
Jamie, keep or banish?
I'm really liberal about this. English and our language is constantly changing. I've discovered you can't win any arguments about usage or grammar or anything anymore. So I'm going.
Sit out this segment, Jamie.
I do have a couple of things.
I'm all libertarian on your ass.
Two things I would ban, but I'll get back to that.
Okay, the second one, I don't like that they want to banish this. No worries. And they claim that it's used too often as a substitute for your welcome. But I find I use it a lot to just let people be at ease or don't worry about something. You know, they bump into you and you say, no worries.
Right. Yes.
They cut you off in the checkout line at Safeway and you say, time to worry. But okay. New normal. Banish new normal. Hate that one.
Okay.
Yep. It stems from how the... Go ahead, David.
I know, I guess. Yeah.
Okay.
I could see where that would be a bit... get overused.
And then they want to banish supply chain. Saying that everyone is using it as an excuse.
Supply chain is a perfectly reasonable, normal phrase to describe something. Why would you want to ban it? We'd have to come up with another word to describe that thing.
It happens to be true.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is.
So, Tori, the ones I would ban in 2022. So first of all, I cannot tell you how tired I am of listening to somebody being introduced and then... It's almost 100% of the time someone says, without further ado.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And can we just introduce somebody without saying, without further ado? And the other one that gets me is, I've noticed that nobody can say deja vu anymore without saying all over again.
Yeah, good one.
Was like funny the first 100 times I heard it, and I know it was attributed to, what's his name? the baseball coach,
Yogi Berra.
Yogi Berra.
Apparently, by the way, he said because Maris and Dave, you can probably correct me on this too. Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle both hit back-to-back home runs in a single game, and he said it was deja vu all over again. But nobody can say deja vu without saying all over. They can't say deja vu anymore. Every time they say it. So I would ban those two things. And not only that, if I were to run for Congress, I would actually introduce federal legislation to ban that.
Wrongly, I feel about it. It'd be more useful than a lot of things you're doing. David, any words you would like to banish? Any you see in the sports world too often?
Well, there's lots of cliches, obviously, in sports that really bad writers use, but I try to stay away from them. So I leave the traffic in the 110% nonsense. I was going to use another word, but it's a family podcast.
There we go. So,
well, as William Sapphire and many other people have famously said about cliches, you should avoid them like the plague.
So I have told you Sapphire quoted me in his language column once, right? Have I told you that?
No, do tell.
So when I was covering what is now called the Washington football team as the beat writer at the Post in the early 90s, they had just drafted to great fanfare a young franchise quarterback named Heath Shuler.
Wow.
And I wrote a story about how he had signed this very lucrative contract. And I wrote a piece saying there is nothing that opposing linemen would, there's nothing they would want to do more than hit Heath Shuler upside his $19 million head.
Oh, good line.
And Sapphire wrote something about the whole etymology of the phrase upside your head, you know, and what it meant, where it came from. And I thought it was kind of cool. They never.
That's very cool.
This wouldn't be Washington if somebody didn't tell a story and then someone else tried to top the story by then making it about them. because Sapphire also wrote a column about me when I was in a confrontation with Donald Rumsfeld in the briefing room. Rumsfeld had written a memo about how the war in, I think it was Iraq, is going to be a long, hard slog. Mm. And we had Rumsfeld and I had a back and forth about what slog meant. And he said it just meant, you know, something that they were working at. And I, of course, had looked it up and had read him the definition. And we had a little moment in the briefing room. And then Sapphire weighed in and definitively answered the question, which I won't go into now. But anyway, I just everything about me personally, because, you know.
I've always thought if you put shock collars on everyone in Washington, D.C., and if they use the first person singular more often than, say, three times every 5 minutes, they'd get shocked.
Yeah.
That would end
Steve's
it.
Steve's got to leave.
Oh, Steve's left. Get him up,
please. I know I would if I were him.
I can't top the William Sapphire story, but I'll tell this very quick story, and then we will talk to Steve Roberts, which is why people are listening to this podcast. William Sapphire never wrote about me or quoted me or anything else. But recently, a friend of mine who's kind of in the news sometimes was really bummed because someone had said something really mean about him. And he was really bummed about it. And he was kind of, you know, nursing his wounds and this and that. And it really just wasn't that bad. And finally, I said, geez, Louise, man. I said, do you remember Bob Novak? And he goes, yeah, Bob. And I said, he once referred to me on the front page of, I don't know what it was, the Washington Post or Wall Street Journal time, as the Gidget of politics. But that's the meanest thing anybody could say to anybody. Oh. And a friend of mine kind of, he took it on board. He thought about, wow, you're right. And he felt better. Okay,
Gidget, let's get with it.
Let's go, Gidget. Jamie, you haven't heard this, but I've learned from DNA testing that I'm 10% Scandinavian and possibly not related to my sisters, which is, there's an upside to everything.
I think I read that somewhere.
Yeah, so Heidi or Gretel will work going forward. Okay. Steve Roberts, welcome to Chatter on Books. Are you still with us or listening to this? Do you want to just run? Go get some dinner.
I'll tell you that I've never been quoted by Bill Sapphire, although there's a great story about Bill Sapphire, who lived in a neighborhood called Kenwood, not far from where I live here in Bethesda. And historically, this was a very segregated neighborhood. Not only were Blacks not allowed, Jews were not allowed. It was a very restricted neighborhood. Sure. Bill Sapphire used to have every year on the night of Yom Kippur, after Jews had fasted all day, when observant Jews had fasted, a breaking of the fast party for all of his Jewish friends. He had been in the Nixon administration, and there are two great things about this. First of all, he loved having this party of all these Jews right in the middle of Kenwood, this neighborhood that had once been restricted, but also it was the perfect reflection of the fact that not every Jewish politician is a liberal, because there were all of these Jews from the Nixon administration, like Henry Kissinger and Herbert Stein and Lyndon Carman. And so it was a very emblematic, interesting event. And Bill was a great guy. But I'll tell you one other story. That I've never been quoted by Sapphire, but I have been in a New Yorker cartoon.
That's the best,
right?
I assume you have this frame somewhere in your
desk. Yeah, it's right over my desk. And so I worked for the New York Times for many years, and I was a congressional correspondent for a number of years. And WQXR, the New York Times radio show in a radio station in New York, had an evening commentary at 6:30. And there were five of us who shared this, and each of us had a different night. And this New Yorker cartoon has this kind of fade looking New Yorker character reading a newspaper with a coffee cup. And the radio is saying, and tonight, the White House correspondent of the New York Times, Hedrick Smith, the political editor, R.W. Apple Jr., our congressional correspondent, Stephen V. Roberts, will now bring you their rendition of Shine On, Harvest Moon. That's the New Yorker cartoon, which I have up.
That's great. Okay, that tops anybody's William Sapphire, Bob Novak story. Okay, Steve Roberts, I was saying at the start of the show, I have known you for so long, I'm not going to say, because it just would date both of us. But you and I must have known each other when I first worked for John McCain back in the 80s.
Right.
Congressional correspondent. And I feel like I know a lot about you, but I've been doing a little bit of research. I know you come from a long line of journalists and writers, and that's in your DNA. But did you really have a great uncle who was an editor of Pravda?
Yes, I did. And his name was Marcus Rogovsky.
Great name.
I used to, now my real family name is Rogovsky, as a matter of fact. It's not Roberts. It was at Ellis Island, my grandfather dropped the ski. So my grandparents in America were named Rogo, R-O-G-O-W. And I still have cousins with that name. And then my dad changed it when I was two. That we took, you know, it was right after World War II, a lot of anti-Semitism. He wanted to be more American. But I've kidded often that a lot of Americans think that every writer for the New York Times had a great uncle who was an editor of Pravda. but I actually had one, Marcus Rogovsky.
Were you ever able to find some of the stuff he wrote for Pravda?
No, I wasn't. But I heard this lore from my grandfather. And interestingly enough, my twin brother was named Mark in part for him.
Wow.
My parents just got it wrong. They just didn't name my brother. My twin brother was an academic his whole life. So they didn't name the kid who became a journalist after the one in Russia. But
he looked wrong.
Yeah, but I've counted it up one way or another, and more than a dozen of my relatives have written books.
That's a freakish number, Steve.
Yeah, I know. It includes my own daughter and daughter-in-law, both of whom have new books coming out this year.
Excellent.
Who's
written the best ones? Wait. Of all your relatives, who's written the best ones?
Who's written the best ones? Well, my daughter wrote a wonderful book that was out last year with Lucinda Robb, the daughter of Chuck and Linda Robb, granddaughter of President Johnson and Lady Bird Johnson. And they wrote a book called The Suffragist Playbook, which was lessons of the suffragist movement for young women and wanted to become political activists. And one of the things that was so interesting about that book was these two young women who wrote the book together, they were classmates at Princeton, but their grandmothers, Lady Bird Johnson and Lindy Boggs, were great friends, lifelong friends. And for these two women to be writing this book about the power of women in politics was a wonderfully symmetrical idea.
I love that. Claude and David, we should have them on for Mother's Day. for a Mother's Day show. That would be fabulous. That would be fabulous. Okay, I vaguely remember this from joining you. Among other things, Steve teaches at GW. He's been there. George Washington University. He's been there for a long time. And, you know, because this is what you do in Washington. If you teach at one of the local universities, you invite all your friends and colleagues to come in and speak to the class, because then you don't have to teach. And I did this a few times with Steve. Your twin brother teaches economics at Harvard. Is that right?
He did. He died a couple of years ago, but he was an economics professor at the Harvard School of Public Health.
And he wrote books you couldn't understand, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, thank you.
They were wonderfully dense and erudite tomes on obscure economic topics. But of course, the relative of mine who wrote five national best-selling books, of course, was my wife, Koki. And
of course.
So she topped us all, certainly in terms of total sales and income and visibility.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about Koki and A Life Well Lived. And people can't see this because this is a podcast, but everybody, if you should listen to this show, when you get this book from your local independent bookstore, the photograph, you couldn't have found a better photograph of Koki, Steve, than this one. She's beautiful. She's upbeat. She's positive. The mischievous look in her eyes is something I have always remembered from Koki, and I was lucky enough to know her for a long time. But let's start with this. Why this book and why this way? In my sense of this is definitely a celebration of Koki's life, who was a remarkable person. Was this also part of your process of the grief of her dying, if I can ask that?
Of course. Of course. She died in September of 2019, and I gave a eulogy, Tori, at her funeral at St. Matthew's Cathedral downtown. There were 1,000 people in the church. And all I did was tell stories. Mm-hmm. And she and I, over our writing lives, of course, we wrote two books together in addition to everything else, and over 1,000 newspaper columns together, many magazine articles. So we had written together a great deal, and we had talked a lot about the writing process. And we had agreed that people learned best about through stories, not through, you know, pedagogy as pedantry as Jamie was saying earlier. They learn through stories. And so I told some stories, some funny, some tearful, at her funeral. And the reaction I got was so strong. People just loved hearing these stories. So I thought, well, maybe I should write more of them down. The process was that it certainly was a way of grieving. It was a way of mourning. It was a way of celebrating. You know, Tori, grief is probably the most elemental and universal of human rituals. Not everybody gets married. Not everybody has children. Not everybody gets bar mitzvah. Not everybody graduates from college. Everybody grieves. Every single person on this earth grieves, and often more than once in their lives. And grief is like water. It seeps through the cracks. If you don't embrace it, if you don't understand it, if you don't acknowledge it, it's still going to get you. And so I decided that this is not only a way of celebrating her life, but of grieving and mourning. And one of the things I decided to do that turned out to be enormously powerful to me, Tori, we had been married 53 years. I had known her 57 years. I knew her awfully well. I'm sitting literally right now in the house we shared for 42 years in Bethesda.
Where she grew up as a child, correct?
It is. She was eight years old when her family moved into this house. But there were also things I didn't know about her. And the main thing, Tori, and you, I think, would find this very meaningful, were her female friendships. Mm-hmm. Because I was not there when she went to the funeral of her friend's parents. I was not there when she was the first person in every maternity ward in Washington scooping up every baby in the zip code that she could find. I was not there at her office at NPR or ABC, where literally young women stood in the hallway in line waiting to seek her counsel and advice. And so I talked to over 50 of her friends, because it was very important to me that I reflect that dimension of her life. People knew a lot about the public Koki. They knew about the enormously important and powerful symbol she was to women, young women who would look up at the television and listen to the radio and say, I can be that smart. I can be that strong. I don't have to hide who I am. This is an enormous contribution. But there was this private Cokie who performed these acts of charity and generosity every single day. She was a very devout Catholic. She lived the gospel. And so I wanted to hear these stories about these private acts that I had not been part of. But also I wanted her women friends to tell the stories in their own words. I did not want to be the guy who tried to interpret the emotions and the feelings and the loyalties and the love these women had for her. So among the most emotional parts of this journey was talking to and hearing these stories, talking to her friends and hearing these stories, many of whom, which I'd never heard before.
Yeah.
Many of which I'd never heard before.
I've watched some of your interviews and I've read what you said about this book and the process. And just so people know before they get the book, because they will all get the book, it's they're almost pillars to the book, right, Steve? You know, wife, mother, journalist, both the early years and the spectacular years where she totally dominated the airwaves, and friend. And it's so funny because I knew her professionally, but I also feel as though I got to count her as a friend. And she and I spent a fair amount of time together doing Talking Ned nonsense for ABC. And that part of it I had seen. I saw young women who worked as PA, you know, as assistants at ABC, hovering, waiting to ask. I had seen that aspect of it. And it was endearing to me that that was something new for you, because just boundless amount of time, just this infinite amount of time she seemed to have. You know, there'd be other people futzing around the green room or the makeup room all nervous and worried about what they're going to say to George Stephanopoulos or whatever, or who cares. And she would have time to talk to some young person who came in asking advice about something, or somebody who just wanted to meet her. Often the other people who'd come in to do those kinds of interviews and those kind of segments would have assistants with them. And they always wanted to talk to Cokie, and she always had time, which is remarkable.
Always had time. And people said to me over and over again, Tori, how did she find the time to do all of this? Let's remember, this was a woman who was basically had three careers. I mean, she was this star for NPR. Then she goes on television and becomes this national figure. And then she writes five best-selling books on top of that. And for the last 17 years of her life, also was an advocate, roaming the world as an advocate for women and children's health, mm-hmm. primarily for Save the Children. With all of that, and yet she had all of this time, and people said, how did she do it? I'll tell you one story that provides a piece of the answer. It's a wonderful woman. You might have known her at ABC, named Jane Ayler, who was the deputy bureau chief there for many years. Jane's younger brother died rather suddenly. She was deeply bereft and took a couple of weeks off, then shows up back at ABC. And the first morning she's back, Cokie walks into her office. Jane tells me this story. This is one of the stories that I had never heard before. And Cokie walks in, Jane is there. Cokie walks into her office, closes the door and says, Jane, talk to me. At which point Jane just breaks down in tears, sobs, remembers for an hour. And through her sobs, says to her, Cokie, you're the busiest person I know. You don't have time to spend all this time with me. And Cokie looks at her and says, Jane, yes, I do. Because right now, the most important thing I can do is be here for you. That's how she did it. She said, this is what's important. She set priorities. She made sure that these personal acts of charity and friendship, and loyalty and love, were important to her. And we all get 24 hours. We get to spend them the way we want to. And she did this because this was right at the top.
Yeah. I'm going to shut up and see what David and Jamie want to talk about. But before I do that, there's a phrase that probably should be banished because it gets used a lot these days, but it's about being present in the moment. Cokie, in my experience, was always present in the moment, whether it was on the set, when some inane senator has said something stupid and she figures out the perfectly apt way to bring the senator down without being disrespectful, or counseling a friend who's just gone through a terrible moment. But she was always present in the moment. It was just remarkable presence that she had.
Yeah, you know, I heard so many of these wonderful stories. I'll tell you one, okay, that I had never heard before. I heard great many, but this is just one of my favorites. So her dear friend, Nina Totenberg, still the to your listeners, probably a familiar voice,
sure.
The longtime Supreme Court correspondent of NPR, and the person who more than anybody was responsible for getting Cokie hired at NPR in 1978. So Nina had been married to an older man, a senator who you probably knew in the Senate, Floyd Haskell of Colorado. He was 26 years older than her. And when he died in very painful circumstances, he was actually on a medevac airplane and flying back to Washington, died in the air. They had a return to Maine where they had started. And as Nina said, Cokie ran Floyd's death. Mm. She said, I didn't know what to do. And Cokie took over. She arranged a funeral. She arranged for him to get buried in Arlington. He was a World War II veteran. She did all of this. And the final act was to pick out his coffin. And so Cokie said, Nina, I'll come with you to the funeral home. Now think about the generosity of spirit and the self-confidence it takes to, at this moment of such pain. Say, I'll be with you at your side when you pick out a coffin for your husband. So they get to the funeral home. Nina tells me this story. And this rather obsequious character is trying to sell her a more expensive casket than she really wants. And so this character looks at her and says, well, Miss Totenberg, your husband was a very tall man. And I think he'd be much more comfortable in this more expensive casket. At which point, Nina and Cokie look at each other and burst out laughing. Now, what kind of friendship does it take? Not only to be there in the moment, as you said, present in the moment, but to be able to laugh with your friend while she buys a casket for her husband. That is an act of friendship.
That is an act of friendship. David, Jamie, I talk too much and I ask too many questions.
No, you don't. You're a good reporter. I am most curious about, you're a Washington media political family, right? And my question is, what did she think about what this town has become in the last 20 years?
Like,
what,
good question.
What did you all talk about with that, with regard to that?
Well, it's a good question, David. As you say, you got to understand the backstory. Not only, I mean, Cokie's father was elected to Congress when she was, before she was born. And he served 30 years. He was killed in a plane crash in 1972. Her mother, Lindy Boggs, then took the seat in Louisiana at a time when there, as Tori knows, there are hardly any women in Congress. There are only 16 women in Congress when Lindy became a member, and served for 18 years. And then late in her life became the American ambassador to the Vatican. So she had this lineage of public service and reverence for politics and reverence for the city and reverence for the Capitol. But what a lot of people don't know was that her mother's family, the Claibornes, by one measure were the second most prominent family in all of American political history. Her first relative to be a member of Congress was elected in 1797 from Tennessee.
Wow.
So, and so it wasn't just her parents. This is a tremendous lineage, right? And so she, I know that one of the things that wounded her deeply in the last years before she died was, it's a cliche, but it's true, the unrelenting partisanship and polarization in the town. Because when she grew up, she grew up here in this house that I'm sitting in right now. Her next door neighbor were Republicans. The man named Ab Herman, he was a major figure in the Republican Party. Ab Herman's daughter, who you may have known, Tori, was a woman named Joanne Emerson, who eventually became a Republican member of Congress from Missouri. Cokie babysat for Joanne Herman, you know, and who the later becomes a Republican member of Congress. One of her best friends growing up was the daughter of Bill Miller, congressman from upstate New York, who ran as Barry Goldwater's running mate in 1964. And she always pointed out that when families brought in, historically in that era, when families came to Washington and lived here, there were all of these relationships at the church, at the school, in the neighborhood, across these party lines. And it was a very, very different texture, very different culture in Washington. And she tells the story, one of the families that the Boggs were closest to were the Fords, Gerald and Betty Ford. And Mrs. Ford, when she was planning her funeral, Tori, summoned Cokie and said, it was a state funeral. She'd been a first lady, right? And she summons Cokie and says, Cokie, I want you to give the eulogy at my funeral, one of the eulogies, because I want you to talk about the Washington that existed when we were all young and growing up here, and the relationship between our families and the respect we had, not only for each other, but for the institution we all served. You served on Capitol Hill in that era. You worked for John McCain, someone who embodied that spirit. Yeah. Now, Hale Boggs and Gerald Ford disagreed on a great many things, but there was an underlying common respect and an underlying belief that they served the same basic set of values. And part of that had to do with the fact that there was the World War II generation. You know, the death of Senator Dole, who you also knew very well, as I did, covered him closely for years, maybe the last, you know, of that generation. Yeah. And, you know, it was true of your boss, John McCain, too, even though he wasn't a World War II veteran. But for people like Bob Dole and George Bush, 41, and John McCain and Colin Powell, who we also lost recently, the shaping experience of their young lives was not politics. It was the military. It was a service. Their first loyalty was to their country, not to a political party. And it was a whole different way of looking at the world, Tori. And so the combination of the fact that these so many of these leaders in Washington for generations had been touched and marked by youthful service in the military, plus the fact that they had brought their families here to Washington, meant that there was a whole different mindset, a whole different set of cultural values that governed the city that has been shredded in recent years. And to answer long answer to your question, David, I think that's the single thing that she would have. I know she did look on Washington and deeply mourn and regret the loss of those relationships.
Yeah. Steve, tell us, why journalism instead of politics? I mean, you went over it very quickly, but she was from political dynasty, and she clearly, she's a patriot in the best sense of the word. And I always thought in her coverage, she put policy and the country first and politics second, those kinds of things. But why, tell us, and I know you talk about it in the book, Cokie, A Life Well Lived, but why journalism and not politics?
Well, it's not just, you know, there were five members of her nuclear family, right? Both of her parents were members of Congress, but both of her siblings ran for Congress. Neither one of them won, but both of them ran. So she was the only one of the five who never ran for Congress. And as she pointed out quite proudly, the only one who never lost an election was my mother, which also was true. But the single biggest reason was she married me. I mean, we met when we were 18 and 19 years old. And as she said many times, and I quote her in the book at length saying this, I was going to be a journalist from the time, literally, I was 12. You know, I ran the sixth grade newspaper and went out for the high school newspaper my first day in high school, went out for the college newspaper my first day in college, had exactly 1 week between graduating from college and going to work for the New York Times. 1 week. So I was always headed in that direction. And so we met when we were between our sophomore and junior years in college. And she always said that it just wasn't possible for her to think about a career in politics being married to someone who was a journalist. And so that was the single biggest reason, but also she had a natural flair for it. The fact is that she loved the camera and the camera loved her. Mm-hmm. It's a little known fact that when she was 21 years old, graduates from college, comes down from Wellesley, comes here to Washington, goes to work for a small TV production company as a young researcher and deputy producer. The woman who ran that company, she was the first but not the last TV producer to understand what a natural, magnetic presence Cokie was before camera. And she started a little show. It was on the NBC station here in Washington. It was called Meeting of the Minds. It was actually on Sunday morning, the lead in to Meet the Press in those days. And Cokie was the host. She was 21.
At 21.
And she, and to try to look older, she had long hair, and it was the 60s, right? She had long hair, which I loved on her. And so she would put her hair up in a bun to try to look older, but it didn't really work.
I have to say, and I have to jump in here, and I really apologize. I'm not trying to make this about myself, but one of the things that struck me about your story is how many parallels it had to my own experience. So like you, I met my wife in college. I was a journalism major. I always knew I was going to, I pretty much knew I was going to go into journalism. My wife was Catholic. We were married in the Catholic Church. My family was, my mother and her family were Jews who immigrated from what is now Ukraine, turn of the century.
It's Ukraine also, for the moment.
They came into New York. They tried to bury their Jewish heritage because they were worried about discrimination. My father, an Air Force pilot, died in a plane crash when I was very young. Like you, I married my wife, Roberta, right after we graduated from college. We're still married. We still live in the same house for 30 years. I'm looking at all this stuff and thinking, like, this is like, I can relate to this. And it just, so the thing that always, so people would say to me, I would tell them my story and they would say, so Jamie, you met Roberta in college, and I only dated her for about 4 weeks before I asked her to marry me because we were about to graduate and I was afraid she'd go away and meet somebody else. And they said, so you just knew, you saw someone, you just knew. And I'm thinking, no, I didn't know anything. I was just I was really young. I didn't know anything. So I'm just curious, aside from the politics and everything else, how did that connection happen and how did it last so long?
Great question.
Because it's so unusual in Washington.
Well, it is a good question. We met at a student political meeting, and something called the National Student Association was very popular in those years in the early 60s. She was a delegate from Wellesley. And I went I was kind of a delegate from Harvard, but I mainly went to cover the convention for the Harvard Crimson. That's how we met. And it turned out back in Boston, our dorms were 12 and a half miles apart. Which was a manageable distance. But I was such a jerk that I didn't call. We went out a couple of times that fall of 1962. I stopped calling, and I had never had a serious girlfriend, and I didn't really know how to have a serious girlfriend, frankly. And I was petrified of commitment and as a typical guy. And it's a long story, but the short version is later that the next spring, I hadn't seen her in 4 or 5 months. Bunch of us had agreed to come to Washington for yet another student political meeting. And it just, the way it was organized is we were going to drive in the same car. And I hadn't seen her in a long time. And I approached the car, it was parked on a side street in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I approached the car and I saw her through the back window of the car as I was approaching. And I thought, you idiot. I mean, this is the girl. What have you been doing? And we got in the car, we drove to Washington, and we spent the weekend in this house, the same house that she and a whole bunch of guys were supposed to stay in this house for the weekend. And gradually, each one who else who was supposed to come had decided not to stay. So I wound up as the only guy here. And this is the first time I came to this house on Bradley Boulevard in the spring of 1963, where I still live, right? Do the math, long time ago. And I'm ensconced in Cokie's girlhood room at the head of the stairs. Cokie is off somewhere else. And I hear a knock on the door. Now, I had a bad cough, and I hear a knock on the door, and I say, it's 1963, so I figure it's not Cokie, right? And in walks my future mother-in-law, future 18-year member of Congress, future ambassador to the Vatican, in an off-the-shoulder pink-colored negligee. And he said, darling, which was her universal form of address, darling, you sound terrible. Drink this. Well, it was probably 2/3 bourbon. I was in shock. I had never met anybody remotely like this in Bayonne, New Jersey, believe me, in an immigrant family, in an immigrant community. And there's a joke in the family that I fell in love with my mother-in-law first and eventually got around the cookie. And there's some truth in that. But,
yeah, there was kind of a graduate vibe to it. I'm thinking the graduate.
Yeah. But, you know, the other thing was that, you know, people had imposed, as Jamie was telling his story, people, this is the early 60s, people had imposed on us this notion that it could never work out. The religious difference, I was, you know, from this Russian Jewish immigrant family. Her family had been in America over 300 years and they were Catholics. And, but that weekend, the next night after I, my future mother-in-law made her entrance. Then, so we spent that Saturday at the student political meeting. I remember it was at American University for the day. And we came back that evening and Cokie and I sat up all night talking in a room that is literally directly below where I'm sitting right now.
Wow.
The room is directly below where I'm sitting. This is spring of 1963. And we stayed up all night and we started talking seriously about whether it was really possible. Was there a path forward for us? And we started to realize that night that the prejudices and stereotypes and assumptions people were imposing on us were not the real core of our relationship, that we actually, the fact that we both came from very strong traditions actually was a source of connection, not of division, because mm-hmm. we saw in each other deeply rooted values of loyalty to our tribes and our traditions. And we were never really apart after that weekend. We drove back to Washington, drove back to Boston. And really that was that, from then on, we were committed to each other. And that's why our wedding rings were inscribed inside Forever Spring, because it was the spring of 1963 that we really fell in love.
So was there a point where you like popped the question, or did it just become obvious that you were going to be together?
I think it became obvious, but I didn't pop the question, much to Cokie's considerable annoyance. Anybody who knew Cokie knew that she was not a woman of few words or of meek opinions.
Or when Cokie had a plan, she wanted the plan to be executed. She did not want to waste time.
Absolutely. And she announced that if we didn't get married, she was moving to California. Now, I'm not quite sure that she knew where California was on the map. I took her seriously. I mean, I knew her well enough to know that she was serious. And so I popped the question, quote unquote. We had this agreement that we would take this romantic horse carriage ride through Central Park. And I was practically at the end of the ride and I still hadn't said the magic words yet. She was furious with me. And I finally did get the words out, but she always said that the way I asked her to marry me was, "Oh, all right, Cokie," which I thought was
nice.
But she apparently held a grudge for quite a long time after that.
One of the reasons I love this book, Steve, is, and anybody who's listened to this podcast, all six of you, know that I have raved about Michelle Obama's memoir, not because it's a political book. It's because it is, my favorite part of the book was her talking about her marriage to Barack Obama. And it was a marriage of two exceptional people going through some pretty extraordinary times, and how they, and she was very honest about the challenges and the difficulties and the mm-hmm. conflicts. So it's as much about people and partnerships in the 21st century as anything else, 20th century. And that's one of the reasons I loved it. And probably my favorite section of the book, A Life Well Lived, was you all talking about that, about how you did have to sit down and actually have conversations about your differences and what united you. And it wasn't always easy. And I want to read you one quote. We got so little time. I want to read you one quote because, again, I knew you first. And I knew you as this rock star congressional correspondent for the New York Times, big honking deal. We thought you were very, very important. And then as time went on, quite frankly, I still knew you as this very important person. But the world, because of the visibility of television, sure, radio, was so huge. Everybody knew Cokie and everybody recognized Cokie. And here's a quote from the book. Now she, Cokie, had a much bigger audience and much bigger income than I did. And inevitably that created conflicts. How did you deal with that?
Well, you know, it's a wonderful question. And the fact that we had fought through other conflicts when we were so young was very important to our ability to deal with this one, because we had experience dealing with reconciling differences. Yeah. We had succeeded at doing that. And that gave us the confidence and the commitment. A lot of young couples, uh-huh, when they hit their first rough patches, they don't know how to get through it. And they throw up their hands in dismay, but we knew that we could do it because we had done it before. And look, I give her 98% of the credit, because as she became more famous, as she became more visible, and you're right, I had to make an enormous transition. I had been the New York Times reporter for a long time. I had been the more visible and dominant figure at least in the public eye. Then she became who she became. But she never, ever, ever, ever lost sight of her true value system. And she never, ever, ever let her visibility, her income, her fame go to her head. I remember once she said to me, in this old house we bought from her mother, it had very small closets and it was an old fashioned house. And she once said to me, if I'm going to be on television, I have to have bigger closets so that my clothes aren't wrinkled every time I go on television. That's like the only time I ever heard her say anything like that. And we actually did put an alteration on the house, and people said, well, did Cokie get walk-in closets? I said, no, she got drive-in closets. But I give her a lot of the credit. But also, look, we were crazy nuts about each other. And we wanted to stay together. We wanted to work it out. We wanted to find a path forward. And if you have the motivation, if you have the incentive, it makes it easier too. And I'm not sugarcoating this. There were times I quote her in the book, she once said that I once said to her, Cokie, I sometimes feel like I'm on just one more item on your checklist that you have to get through in the course of a day. There was a period when we both were doing Sunday shows, and she was, of course, the big deal star on ABC. And I was doing the roundtable on CNN Sunday show every Sunday. Mm-hmm. And a woman wrote an article for some magazine of blessedly forgotten about how what a big star Cokie was and what sort of a schlepper I was, because, you know, the food at the ABC green room was so much better. And look, there were people who looked at us from the outside and thought, look, this must be terribly hard for Stephen. We once went on The View, the TV show. Barbara Walters was on the show that day. And she must ask me 6 times, how do you, your male ego survive being married to such a powerful and attractive woman? And I kept saying, Barbara, it's not a problem. You know, I'm her biggest fan. And Barbara would not accept that. She couldn't understand that I felt that way. And that also was part of it, Tori. From the time we were kids, I knew that I was married to this extraordinary woman. And in many ways, frankly, I think I had more confidence in her than she had in herself.
I believe that.
So it was not a surprise to me when the world discovered this, because I discovered her a long time before. And that's a big part of what attracted me. Sure, there were all of these youthful hormones pulsing, you know, at age 19. To the day she died, she was an extremely beautiful woman. But it was so much more than that. And look, there were times of strain. There were years of strain. There was a period when both of our children left home to go to college, which is a change in the dynamic of any family. It happened to coincide almost exactly with her going on ABC and becoming more and more visible. it coincided with my leaving the New York Times after 25 years, which was a very painful exit for me. These were very hard years. In fact, my last year at the New York Times was very painful. I had a new bureau chief I didn't get along with, and he didn't get along with me. And when I finally left and moved to U.S. News, Cokie said, I had my happy husband back. That for a year, I was a very difficult person to live with in that last year at the time. So I am not pretending that this was all smooth by any means. But the bottom line was, A, we wanted to fix it, and B, we had the experience of fixing it before, and that's what got us through.
Awesome. Okay, let me get you out with this, and then we'll do 60 seconds more, because we like to go from deep and meaningful and really poignant to completely stupid. But let me get you out with this, and I think Karen Tumulty in the book, Cokie, A Life Well Lived, said something which struck me every time I was in Cokie Roberts' presence, and she said she never got cynical. Cokie never got cynical. Which is true. At least I never saw it. I don't know anybody who ever saw it. If anybody had the DNA, the background, the experience, the work, the everything to be cynical, it would be Cokie Roberts, but she wasn't. So what kept her as positive as she was?
Well, a lot of this, as we've said, came from her heritage, came from the fact that she grew up in a political family. She saw inside political families. She saw the sacrifices people made. Her family grew up without any money. I mean, her father was this major national figure, but they lived on his congressional salary.
Yep.
You know, she went to a Catholic school where twice a year the uniforms, kids wore their own clothes because the uniforms had to get cleaned. And she had to wear the same outfit every time because that was the only outfit she owned.
Yeah.
She saw the sacrifices and she saw the dedication without being, you know, starry-eyed about this. She loved politics. She loved the Congress. Her seventh birthday party was at the U.S. Capitol. Her mother would take her up when she was a kid, and her mother sometimes worked in her father's office, needed to a babysitter. She would put her on the Senate subway. You know, that subway, as you well know, which you rode maybe 1,000 times in your life. And she would say to the guy who ran the subway, just babysit for her for a while I go. And that bred a love for the institution and a respect for in our household, politics was not a dirty word. Politics was a noble word. And that changed the whole perspective, you know. Many nights after, you know, we knew each other on the Hill in the 80s, because we covered the same beat for 8 years, from 78 to 86. Of course, in those years, when you had parking, you had the press plates you could park on the grounds of the Capitol. And so we would commute together. And at the end of the night, we'd gather at the parking lot. And I can't tell you how many hundreds of times this happened. She would look up at the dome lit up at night. And she would literally get teary-eyed and say, look how beautiful that is. She wasn't just talking about the physical building. She was talking about what it represented, as a symbol of democracy, a symbol of the country. You use the word patriot. That's true about her. And that's why she never became symbol, because she believed. She was a believer, Tori. She was a believer. She believed in the church. She believed in marriage. She believed in her family, she believed in her friends, and she believed in politics. She was a believer in the best sense.
In the best sense. I know I feel extraordinarily lucky to have known her at all and spent a lot of time with her. I know you believe that deeply. But boy, talk about somebody who touched this town in a really, really important, important way. And I really hope everybody gets this book. Again, if you care about politics, great. It's a great book. If you care about a remarkable woman who broke glass ceilings, great. But it's a really fascinating look at a really, really interesting couple. Again, thank you so much, Claude. Thank you for making everything happen. We are off next week for the holiday. I really hope everybody stays healthy and is careful and all that. And then we come back on January 24th, Lisa Gardner, who's been on before, AP calls her. She's one of the greatest psychological thriller writers of the world. She comes back, which will be great. Jamie McIntyre, we're glad you're off the injured reserve list.
Thank you.
Great to see you, my friend, as ever. Thank you. And everybody, thank you for listening. Stay well, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. And we're out.
Guests on Chatter on Books are entitled to be entered into a raffle to win a home version of Chatter on Books, which includes a deck of laminated playing cards, a colorful game board, and an hourglass-style timer. Only one entry per person in case of duplicate prizes. Ties will be awarded. Must be present to win.